came up from, I guess, from the southwest toward us in the last few days. Who did or did not suffer damage? I know that the secondary is what kept your tower from becoming a spring, but I think you said that the wire of the 260-foot loop antenna, was that struck, Mel? Go ahead.
It was torn right down, and lucky that the wire let go, not the support. Well, the support sort of got moved out of place somewhat, but alright, I was able to fix that up. Yeah, I sliced up the loop. I can't do a heck of a lot out there because of the wind and the miserable and the cold and all, so I just lowered down the loop and so I can keep it on the air. I just stripped the two wires and put it together, and right now it's twisted together with a regular lock nut, electrical lock nut, the twist lock type. So I just twisted it on there and taped it over, and that'll have to hold. The weather gets, nice again, warm up, and it'll be properly soldered up and all. That's what I say. I was set if a guy wire, let's go with that kind of force of a tree limb. That was a heavy limb because I cut it up in pieces with a chainsaw, and each piece weighs considerable. A couple of the limbs did come down the area here in Brooklyn, and one tree, it actually took a minivan and mashed it right down. Amazing. I took a look at that stick. It just parted it right down to the floorboards over.
Wow. So, sounds to me like your 45-foot in the air loop antenna, full wave loop on 80 meters, is back in operation by way of those repair procedures. If I tried to ask you the average amount of improvement in signal-to-noise ratio on your properly tuned internal loop inside the shack with you versus the 45 feet in the air full-wave loop, would you say one whole S unit of signal-to-noise ratio improvement is a typical number that you get with the internal fraction of a wavelength loop? Back to you, Mel.
Now it's according to where the noise is coming from. If I can if I can separate, in other words, if they're not in line, the noise, that the signal is not exactly in line, and I can remove the main receiving loop and aim that at the direction of the signal, and it's fairly sharp. I'll tell you, I was amazed how the thing works at all. I'm not even sure sometimes, what I'm really dealing with, because it looks like sometimes some magic going on, if you know what I mean, how sharp it could be and how you can peak it so, that it's so defined, that peak. If I can get that set, the main loop, and then if the noise is somewhere off, anywhere from about 25-30 degrees from the inline of that main loop, I set that on the noise, and I put it then through the noise squasher and the Q multiplier. I take an S9 noise that I'm receiving on the regular loop, the outside transmitting loop. If I listen to that, I hear, I say, an S9 noise level, and I'll take that noise level down to S3. Yep, easily. Sometimes even lower than that. Like I said, depends on where it's coming from. Unfortunately, some nights, like the other night, we were getting it from all directions. Just the band was just plain noisy, but not the heck of it. A lot you can do with this thing, except have plenty of power on the band. Everybody's running plenty of power, and do whatever you can with the receiver, over.
Okay, so on some nights, S9 noise can be brought down to S3. On the worst case night, are you still getting at least a fraction of a S unit of improvement in signal-to-noise ratio, properly tuned internal loop versus external loop? Back to you, Mel.
I always say you can get some improvement because, you're really touching up everything to optimize it because you're turning the loop in the exact direction of the station. You're also really peaking it I mean, the it's extremely sharp, the peaking on that receiving loop, because, you know, you're dealing with, like I've said many times, who would ever think something that's less than 0.1 wavelength on 75 meters would even, you know, be more than that. You say, oh, somebody says, sure, you put your finger on the receiver, you know, hang a piece of wire and everything, you'll hear something, of course. But who would ever think that it would perform this, you know, beautiful? I mean, you know, if you let it try it, that's why I said that a lot of people, it's a simple thing to put together. Give it a try, and you'd be amazed at the results. I mean, it's so little of it is written up in the antenna manuals and all. It's just like stuck on the last page, if you notice this, in the antenna manual on Luke's deck over.
Well, the looped antennas were not on the end of the antenna, ARL antenna book, but somewhere in the middle. But still, your kind of loop wasn't a major section. People in the past made the mistake of thinking, because the loop is electronically small in wavelength, that its performance must be electronically small. People make the mistake of assuming that. The magic of resonance is that once an antenna resonates, it develops essentially the full effective capture area, a full, flat-out, half-wave dipole. Hard to believe, but that's what happens. Did you get some mail that we should be considering, Mel? K2KE1, K2LIW.
One final word on it. This is K2KEY. Years ago, AEA came up with this loop that they were marketing, and it had a vacuum variable in it, and we're very well made thing that you could put up. It was actually designed when I spoke to some people that are either a temporary location or have to put up something somewhat small and conspicuous or whatever, and you could put this thing up on a roof and remotely control the turning of the loop, rotating it, and also the adjustment of the variable capacitor. And he, of course, advertises that it'll cover 80 to 10 meters and full coverage on the bands and all. And it was very expensive. It wasn't a cheap item, and never took off. They eventually dropped the item, but it was based on the same principle, except they, of course, constructed it for a good outside, survival, and made out of a hunk of bent up piece of 3/4 inch or an inch conduit into a, no, in fact, it was copper. He had a copper piece. He used copper. He said, he explained that everything has to be extremely, you know, as non-resistant as possible, and joints and everything. So he used a copper, copper circle about, I don't think it was about 3 or 4 feet or so in diameter, but nothing ever came of it, Dick.
And do we, go ahead, Rich.
Now, I had one of those loops, I guess it was in the 80s. That was close. It was a 30-inch loop, as I recall. It didn't cover 80 to 10. It covered 30 meters. Yeah, 10 megahertz, 30-meter band through 10 meters. And it actually worked pretty well. The only thing, of course, the Q is very high. So if you moved up and down the band, you had to adjust it. But it was only good for 100 watts because, you know, circulating current gets very high. You had a capacitor. I had it mounted off the back of the house. It actually worked quite well. For what it was the beam, but it worked as well as any other omnidirectional antenna. Yeah, Dick, and to Leo.
When did you stop losing it, Rich? And did you replace it with something a little bit bigger?
Yeah, I don't remember exactly. I went from one thing to another. But I've been off the air for a number of years on HF. When I got back on, that's what I used. It's the ATA isolope. And MFJ, I don't know if theirs is good, but is still on the market. They've got two versions of it. One covers 10 to 30, like the 88, and then they have another one that covers 15 meters to 40 meters. Apparently they can't get coverage on one, but I'll bet it's not a bad antenna. But like Mel said, people, and you said, Dick, people think because it's small and that it's not going to work, but it does work because it's the rest of the antenna.
There was a station trying to sign in, but extremely noisy. I'm not sure we're going to be able to copy, so you're going to have to make some changes to location, antenna aiming, or power to get into this repeater. Want to try again? Okay, back to you, Bill.
This is K2KDY. All right, something else came up. In fact, we had a brief discussion about it today on the 10-meter net. And, in fact, my brother pointed it out to me that he was looking to buy a large screen plasma. And he says, is this correct? That this thing is going to use more electric than right now than my 30-inch regular TV, you know, picture tube TV. And plasma TV rated at using some of them 500 to 600 watts of electric. And in fact, he saw the article in New York Times, and it said that they're, you know, talking about reducing, you know, energy by electrical equipment that is got a better EER and everything, and here we are coming up with new TV sets that are going to use sometimes 2 and 3 times what the current model TV sets are using. So is this a factor, or is, this happens to be for only one particular base model or whatever? Have you heard anything to this that they said this is going to possibly cause additional heavy load on the grid, Dick, over?
No, I haven't heard that, Mel, but I'm going to start listening for it. I'm going to start asking questions. I think a modern-day television set rarely goes above 100 or 150 watts, and if some of these new large-screen, high-depth televisions, plasma-type, consume 600 watts, not only is that a significant amount of electrical consumption, but essentially all of that wattage goes into heat ultimately. So it's also going to, you're going to pay for it twice. You're also going to pay for it when it comes to the air conditioning you turn on in the summertime. Ain't that pleasant? Back to you, Mel.
KCQOES.
Mr. OES, go ahead, Fred.
Yeah, I recently heard an article in the news about referencing that, and they said that it was the average. They couldn't pin it down to being one particular brand, but the average was that the electrical consumption is double CRTs.
How about that? Thank you, Bill.
Okay, this is K2KEY. Well, you know, I remember years ago an instrument that had a small plasma display, and I know it had a backlight on it. I was wondering, is that... you think that is what is responsible? Because I'm trying to picture what an electronic they could have in that that's going to use that kind of amount of wattage. The only thing I can think of is that backlight. Is it possible the backlight is going to produce that much, you know, light and heat, Dick, over?
And if so, I'll bet you there's going to be ways of making it more efficient. People who have traded over from incandescent light bulbs to these compact fluorescent bulbs have experienced a significant decrease in wattage. And then there are people who have gone one step beyond that, where they're using the laser diode type, what do they call them? I guess they're called laser diode lights. And they're even more efficient than the compact fluorescent. That's the good news. The bad news is I'm hearing from Bill, WB6UGZ, that right now the laser diode type lights, illuminators, don't seem to go above 24 watt equivalent. But still, they are a heck of a lot more efficient. So I'd like to believe in the future someone's going to find a backlighting scheme, whether plasma lighting or fluorescent screen or laser diodes that are going to be more efficient. Light emitting diodes, that's what I'm looking for, LED.
Yeah.
I'm holding on to an LED flashlight, and I think it has, I'm about to count how many bulbs to it. 12 little light emitting diodes. And it is bright enough that when it shines into your face, if you opened your eyes, it would be uncomfortable. Looking for the brand name on it. Looks like the brand name is Top, T-O-P. It's the only thing I can see that seems to have a brand name. I'm going to look a little bit further. But you're going to see, yeah, Top is the brand name. Top LED flashlight. Beautiful little thing. So more and more of these are going to come about. There are light-emitting diode-type flashlights, which will run some ridiculous number of hours, like 10 and 12 hours on one charge. And the battery inside is not much bigger than a T-cell. So I think there's going to be improvement. Hang in there. Back to you, Mel. K2RIW.
Comment.
Go ahead, comment. Start off with your name and call letters if we don't already know who you are.
This is Fred Dick. This is Julia. The downside to the fluorescence versus incandescent is that there's more mercury that's going to wind up in our landfills.
Which brings up an interesting question. I've already had a few of them fail on me. I presume there is a recommended method of disposal of those. Have they come up with a day of the month when they do your curbside pickup that they'll pick up compact fluorescent bulbs? What do you think, Fred?
Not to my knowledge, but I've seen it mentioned in, we get a circular here in town about recycling, and there are a lot of towns, from what I understand, in the country are trying to figure out what to do with them. They haven't figured out what to do with them yet.
Yeah, I'm looking at the inside of my LED flashlight with the 12 bulbs, and it runs on 1, 2, 3. Yeah, it's running on 3 AAA batteries, and I think it claims some ridiculous number of hours. So, light-emitting diodes are coming a long way. I'm using a light-emitting diode laser pointer. I think it's a light-emitting diode. Yeah, I'm going to call it that, which is green, and mine runs 5 milliwatts. You can buy them up to 100 milliwatts, and my goodness, are they bright. K2KUI, K2RIW on the TechNet.
2QIQ in comment.
Go ahead, Glenn.
Yeah, just a quick thing about disposal. I'm not sure about a lot of other towns on Long Island, but I know here in the town of Oyster Bay, we have a special pickup. Normally aerosol cans, oil, and basically any other things like that, like certain TV sets that you don't want to throw in out of your regular pickup. Normally the town will have a spot where you actually can go and drop it off here in the town of Oyster Bay and still sort. But I think quite a few other towns in this area have something similar.
Do you remember, Glenn, them specifically talking about compact fluorescent bulbs as something that's appropriate for that disposal method?
In general, they'll accept anything that normally you don't want to put out in the trash. They haven't highlighted LEDs yet as something, but in general, if you have, like, even old computers, old television sets, anything that you normally wouldn't want to put out there, basically sort. They take it in a special location. They handle it, separately. You know, it's like oil goes in one area, the aerosol can goes in another. And basically, they kind of take care of it for you.
Well done. Sounds like you live in a progressive town. How come Manhattan Beach Maybe Manhattan Beach is already doing that. Is that true, Mel? K2KEY, K2LIW.
W-A-2-C-D-O.
Andy, recognize Mel first. Go ahead, Mel.
Yeah, they have a place here in Brooklyn where you can take your electronics and all that kind of stuff to one particular location where it'll be properly handled. In fact, I just got a circular from them, and to remind us the location here in Brooklyn. Of course, we only have put out the garbage for tomorrow morning. We have to separate. I have a can with I put in bottles and things of that container. And then I have a separate container for paper. But for putting out monitors, fluorescents, compact fluorescents, and a number of these other things, they have a specialized place we can take it to. And they tell you up to 6 items per car load, no commercial cars, no commercial trucks or any of that stuff, and no scavenging. I'm just reading it. Okay, anyhow, last word on plasma TV set that they said here. I read a little further on the article that was in Time, and it said that it'll add on the average family will be at least a $50 to $75 a month additional cost on your electric bill. How do you like that? That is something. That's hard to believe, Dick, but I guess they must have researched it out. Okay, go ahead, turn it over to Andy, and then I'll take a look and see what else we got here. Go ahead, Andy.
Yeah, something like 4.5 hours per day is the amount of television the average American watches. W-A-2-C-D-L, K-2-R-A-W.
How you doing, guys? W-A-2-C-D-L. Two things. Firstly, Glenn, K-C-2-Q-I-Q, is there a way I can give you a phone call or give you my email address so I can just speak to you? And then I have a question. Can I ask Glenn that question?
You got a question?
Yeah, absolutely, Andy. My email address is glen@hoflink, and you can send any information there, and you can exchange telephone numbers and et cetera.
Okay. glen@hoflink.com, C-O-M?
Yes, it is, Andy.
Okay, I'll give you an email in a few minutes and my phone number, or if you can give me yours. Okay. Here's something I found interesting, Dick, and I'm wondering if you came across this problem. I actually noticed it on a few different spectrum analyzers. Dealing with plasma TVs and different sorts of CRTs, LCDs, TFTs, plasma, and all the others that are out there. One thing that I noticed this week, I was using an Inritsu portable spectrum analyzer for the work that I do in the field, and I noticed that without seeing any signal, I was just tuned to a random frequency. Looking at the noise floor of the spectrum analyzer, I was noticing spikes coming out of the noise floor at about 15 dB level or whatever the noise floor was. And let's say the noise floor was down at minus 95 or so. I noticed that these spikes were all across the band. Interestingly enough, I removed the antenna. It has a portable antenna. It's battery operated, this unit. It's rather expensive too. I removed the antenna and the spikes disappeared completely. Upon some investigation, I found that the spikes were actually being caused by the spectrum analyzer itself. And what I did was I inserted I was using a rubber duck antenna, which is mounted on top of the unit. It's got an end connector on the top that sticks up. What I did was I connected a separate antenna with a little piece of coax cable so I could move the antenna around. And I found that if I move the antenna near the LCD, or in this case, TFT display, actually a few inches from it, those spikes really jumped up. They jumped up about 20 or 30 dB from the noise floor. I'm saying to myself, these fluorescent displays have a backlight, and I believe they are a fluorescent light of some type. I believe also that fluorescent light operates on a high voltage. Is it possible that the power supply, the high voltage supply that's powering the backlight is creating this noise that I'm seeing, which really shouldn't be there? What do you think of that? Back to you.
Waiting for the beep, Andy. There we go. You've hit on something that's significant. To my knowledge, any of the display devices that require a high voltage to run things like a fluorescent tube run on an inverter. The inverter is taking the 3, 4, 5, 6, whatever it is, volts out of the main battery of your unit and stepping it up to the voltage that's high enough to run that that lighting source. There are inverters and there are inverters. There are inverters that can step up the voltage and do it in an extremely quiet manner. But they are massive, require a lot of shielding, and they're expensive. If you and I were running a company building a piece of instrumentation like that, and you're in competition with other companies producing a similar piece of instrumentation, you may not have the luxury of putting in the Cadillac inverter that is well shielded and very noise free. So you're going to get a certain amount of noise out of these displays. I know of people that are trying to put fancy receiving electronics into things that have displays to them, and that could give them an awful lot of grief. So I think you're onto something, and I guess the day will come when someone will eventually set a standard as to what amount of noise, radio noise, at what frequencies, is allowed to come out of the display device so that it does or doesn't affect other nearby instruments. Roughly how far did you have to move the antenna away from the display in order for the effect to disappear, Andy? To the A2CDL, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Okay, there's no beep on my signal, by the way. a foot or more, at least. Minimum of a foot or more. Due to the sensitivity of the analyzer itself, and due to the level of the noise coming out of that display. And it's only when I place the antenna across the front of the display in any plane. Let me just clarify that. It's got to be, parallel to the display, not perpendicular to it. I didn't try it perpendicular, actually. Actually, I could do that, but I didn't think to it at the time. But parallel to it, sweeping the antenna, and this antenna, by the way, is just a regular quarter-inch UHF whip antenna, a couple of inches. Sweeping it across the display, you can actually see from end to end that it's pretty uniform from top to bottom and from side to side on that LCD it could be TFT, I'm not sure which, display that this Anritsu analyzer has. So that's my point, and you brought it up. You confirmed that, you know, how much radiation are these displays producing? And for that to actually affect its own spectrum analyzer, which this is a $15,000 piece of equipment, is, in my opinion, not a good design for an equipment that's this expensive. I would think that the power supply is a switching type of some type, and it's producing the harmonics all over the place. So whatever frequency it's switching at, which is probably a pretty high frequency in the first place. So I just thought I'd bring that up, because I don't know what the TFTs and plasma displays and all the other displays that are out there, what it's really creating. It would be interesting to see, just like you mentioned. Think back to you. Thanks.
Again, I was waiting for the beep on your signal, and there won't be one. The spectrum analyzer is often used in a completely closed coaxial system, Andy, where a coaxial cable goes from the spectrum analyzer over to a signal generator or receiver or something else like that, which is naturally shielded. not everybody every day puts an antenna directly on a spectrum analyzer and operates the antenna close to the screen. But you've discovered a vulnerability that I think is going to have to be worked on someday. There's going to be a spec on that, in my opinion. While you're on a modern-day spectrum analyzer, which many of them have digital signal processing, in order to create the equivalent filter, the real filter bank that used to be there for the 10 hertz, 30 hertz, 100 hertz, 1 kc, 3 kc, 5 kc, 10 kc, 100 kc, and so on. 1, 3, 5, 10 ratio. All of those filters used to be quite massive. Now they're done with digital signal processing. That's the good news. But the digital signal processing is not running at a 4 gigahertz rate of a process. Therefore, there's some latency. I've noticed that the compact, portable-type spectrum analyzers, network analyzers, and service monitors, the update rate on the screen is a heck of a lot slower. There are a couple of occasions where I was doing something where I had to have rapid update. In one case, I was tuning a 10-pole filter. And every time you moved a particular screw on that filter, one of the tuning screws, the display changed grossly. And as such, I'd want to see that in real time to know when I'm tuning the screw the right way. And I've noticed that when I use some of the more modern-day portable pieces of equipment, you turn the screw and sit there and wait 5 seconds for the screen to update. And if you have to wait 5 seconds every time you move a screw a 30th of a turn, so to speak, you may not be able to live long enough to properly tune a 10-pole filter. I wonder if you've seen that phenomenon. In my case, I had to backstep to pieces of equipment that were 10 and 15 and 20 years older, which had rapidly updating real-time displays, so that I could do that tuning procedure. That's A2CDL, A2LAW on the TechNet.
Okay, W-H-C-D-O. Yeah, I do agree with the digital signal processing on these new pieces of equipment. You have to sort of get accustomed to the screen and how to analyze it, you know, differently than a real-time CRT. I would agree with that. This analyzer, by the way, is made by Anritsu. It's currently manufactured. It's a new device, new piece of equipment. It's got a color CRT, which is nice. And you could store, you could compare, and all sorts of different features. And it's portable. In this case, just to let you know, the connector, getting back to that for a second, if you want to operate it in the field, there's a carry strap that you just put hanging around your neck and you carry it like a laptop computer, so to speak. And the antenna sticks out from the top of it. It comes with its own rubber duck antenna, which I think is just a random frequency antenna. And that's the one that we were using for the time being. And noticed that these spikes all over the screen until we did some investigating on that. So that's the way it's built, that's the way it's designed, and I'm again surprised that it's generating this because it would interfere with the signal that you're trying to look at, especially if you're down to a very narrow band resolution and you want to see something that's down in the noise. These spikes will be a lot bigger than that under those conditions. So that's true. They should have some standard for that. All right.
Hello, Andy. Can you hear me?
Sure, I can.
Fantastic. What is the model number of that Anritsu? And is that your personal piece of equipment, or is that supplied by your salt mine?
No, it's supplied by not even my company. It's another company that's working with us. It's the MT. I think it's an 8802, but I have to check the number on it because I did not write it down. But it's currently available on their website, and it's one of the later models.
The MT 8802 goes roughly from what frequency to what frequency, Andy?
You guys are going to kill a timer.
Yeah, I got to wait for the beep. Okay, up to 5 gigs. This one goes up to 5 gigs. Go ahead.
That's what I wanted to know. And I thank you. Good information. So, roughly a foot away required, and that was in one of the most sensitive modes with the input RF attenuator set at minimum, and maybe the internal preamplifier was turned on. Were you in the most sensitive mode when you were doing that? And I think you said it was a rubber duck-like antenna you were using. Back to you, Andy.
Do we need to worry why would a question or comment on that device?
We'll get to you in a second. Go ahead, Andy.
Okay, yeah, I don't want to forget about the beep because I know the timer will, the ILP will time out. Thanks, Eric. we were just looking at the noise floor, and this was a new device we just turned on. We just received it, turned it on. We're just playing with it, getting used to the feel of it, to how it works, the features, and so on. Preamp was turned off at the time. Noise floor was around neg 95. Spikes were coming up all across the noise floor at about neg 90 or even a little bit higher than that. So at least a 5 dB increase in noise floor spikes than the noise floor itself. Minus 95 to about minus 90 or so at the time. But the point is that this is where it's coming from, something with a display. I can't see it coming from anywhere else unless there's something else that's going on which I don't know about. Back to you.
When you said the noise floor is at minus 95, since most spectrum analyzers on the lowest frequency range, the noise runs very close to minus 80 dBm with a 1 meg filter. So at minus 95, I'm guessing, well, that's with no preamp turned on. At minus 95, I'm guessing you are running something like a 30 kilohertz resolution bandwidth at the time. Is that approximately true, Andy?
Exactly. I was running 30KC, right on the nose.
As you can tell, I've worked with spectrum analyzers, and almost all of them have very close to the same sensitivity, minus 80 dBm per megahertz in the lowest band. And then they go down about 6 dB per band as you go to the higher harmonic band. WA2YY, I think it is, or something like that. Correct me on your call letter, sir. Tell us your name and then your question or comment. KQRIW, my name is Dick.
Hard to get in there on the internet because of the pauses between this, tough. Joe, W2RY is the call. I have a comment on that unit that you're talking about, not directly on the spectrum analyzer, but on a related product that they make that has the same color display.
Very fine, Joe. Give us your comment on a very similar Inritsu unit. Tell us what unit and what you observed.
Yeah, I recently used the S331D, and which is a unit that's designed to sweep between 25 meg to 4 gig, and it seems to work okay as far as electrical performance, but their performance with the screen is horrible if you got that thing in strong sunlight. If you got strong sunlight behind you with a dark screen with the color display, use of the markers and so forth, the screen is almost impossible to see in strong sunlight. I've talked to them directly about it, and they don't seem to be doing anything about the particular problem thing, and that they are aware of it. Because I've used an older unit, which had a monochrome type of screen, which was much, much easier to see with contrast, with strong sunlight behind it. But that particular unit is very hard to use. You've got the sunlight behind you. You almost have to have something or someone stand behind you and shape the thing to be able to see what that screen is doing for you. It's not easy to read. And my question on that unit, have you ever taken a signal generator and put a signal generator into that unit, into its antenna input, and actually verified the thing can actually see something down at minus 80 or minus 90? Is it actually truly displaying something that low, or is it giving you a false reading because of the noise floor? You think you're seeing something that sensitive, and it's really not going down that low. Because some of their earlier units they had were horrible as far as the low-end sensitivity. You could put the thing down at minus 80 or minus 90, and you couldn't even see a signal at that level at all. It wouldn't appear at all.
Let's see if Andy has comments on either one of those. Weak signal confirmation, and have you ever used it in direct sunlight? W2CDL, K2RIW in the tech net.
Okay, and hello, Joe. First question regarding sunlight, no. Just the opposite. I'm actually below ground. There's no sun down there. We just got this unit. I was just playing with it for the first time. Just to get it, as I mentioned, just to get a feel for it. So I did not get a chance to put it through all its paces by feeding a signal in from a generator, seeing how things are. I just didn't have the time to do it because I was in the middle of other testing at the same time. I was pretty busy with a lot of things going on at once. But I did notice that right off the bat. And I did a quick test just by changing antennas just to see, and made that determination. That's why I brought it up. But no to the sun, didn't try it yet. No to the generator. And that'll be done this week because we're going to be making more tests. So that'll be done. I'll give you a follow-up on that for sure.
Jay with a comment, Andy.
Okay, you can Eric and... Oh, I'll get back to Dick first and Eric ahead.
Yeah, Eric, you have to wait for the beep. That was a joke. You got it, Eric.
Yeah, I do, but he's going in a different way, so he can hear me when I talk. One thing you should check, Andy, is that I know on mine, when I hook an antenna to it, all sorts of funny stuff happens, unless I terminate the outputs and the tracking, make sure the tracking generator is turned off, and there's a sweep output in the back, and there's also a local oscillator output in the back, and unless you terminate, it do radiate.
Okay, I'll just make a quick comment. That is terminated. The all other ports are terminated at 50 ohms, and it comes with its own termination that was installed. So that was done.
Yeah, I got a comment on that one, Eric, and that is, if the output connector is a BNC, it's awfully difficult to read much of a signal from a BNC connector where the shell of the connector is properly grounded. You got it, Eric.
Yeah, well, most of my stuff is SMA, and if you don't put the little cap over it, they do radiate.
At 10 gigs, you're absolutely right. I personally measured the radiation from a 10-gig signal generator from an SMA just sitting in somebody's backyard, and I was 10 miles away with my particular receiving system. But when it comes to 1-gig type signals, I think it's awfully difficult to radiate much of a signal from an SMA. But when in doubt, obviously they should be capped and terminated. And so where Andy was moving his antenna probe near and further away from the screen, I think he had rather strong confirmation that the screen itself was making the noise. I wonder if you'd agree with that, Andy. Wait for the beep.
Okay. Yeah, I heard the beep. Yeah, I think it's coming from the high voltage supply, which causes the backlight to light. It's interesting because I have in my possession a LCD computer monitor where the backlight went out because the high voltage switching transistors blew out for some reason. I don't know why. So I was looking into that. Very little information do I have on this particular piece because the manufacturer doesn't give any schematics of anything. But that's my opinion that is coming from the high voltage display. And by the way, as a footnote, in this particular case, you can't turn off some analyzers. I know some of the older ERISUs, you could adjust the intensity of the backlight, which you can. That has no effect. I tried that. But you can't turn off the backlight. Like Joe said, in different lighting conditions,
Sometimes you can you have the option of reversing the display, in other words, a negative display, as opposed to a positive, or you can turn on and off the backlight. This one you can't. The backlight's always on, but you can just dim it. You can only do that. So I would have liked to have turned it off completely and see if that made any difference. Nick, thank you.
I got another comment. You got it, Eric. Yeah, I didn't realize it. No, I just think it's spectrum analyzed. I'm always thinking CIT. But, I have a, what do I have? An Avantech U3661. It goes up to 40 gigs. And that has exactly a liquid crystal display with a backlight. First of all, the backlight generator generally makes square waves. You know what that does. They run around 40-odd kilohertz or so. That's one thing, but the other thing is the logic that drives the display itself. Very much a transmitter, and I know they make a lot of effort to shield that stuff, but some of it is just like impossible to shield. So, besides, most spectrum analyzers really are intended to be hooked to an antenna directly, or at least right in front of its face. That's my thing.
DC2QAQ with a comment.
Go ahead, Glenn. Wait for the beep.
Yeah, it's an interesting thing using portable spectrum analyzers to do antenna measurements or trying to receive from the antennas. I've borrowed quite a few of them from work, you know, in different bands and all over the place. One of the things I found, in order to normalize a lot of the measurements so that I could get a lot of data that would match from analyzer to analyzer and location to location, I found it was sometimes they supply either a little wing nut in the back to the ground or like a banana plug opening in the front where you can attach the analyzer. So when you're running on battery power, there's really no reference ground to attach to. And sometimes picking up the local ground will take care of a lot of very, very strange performance trying to measure an open antenna on the receiver port.
Roughly what frequency were you testing when you did that, Glenn? If you were down at HF frequencies, I think you're absolutely right. When it comes to upper VHF and UHF frequencies, it's quite possible the case itself is a moderately good counterpoint for the antenna. Back to you, Glenn.
Yeah, I originally was doing it mostly in the HF area, but I also found when I was starting to even monitoring the, you know, the 2-meter and the 440 stuff that it did affect the ground floor. And certain things that, certain amounts of the measurements, you know, you could see like a 3 to 6 dB difference in some of the measurements where, you know, if you were trying to just make a very, very slight adjustment to the antenna and see if there's a difference, by just grounding it, it seems to make the measurements a lot more stable.
Andy, when you were holding your rubber duck-like antenna on a cable near the display, and I think you said only when the antenna was parallel to the display did you pick up the noise, and it didn't matter at the orientation whether it was horizontal, vertical, or slant 45, but you didn't try it perpendicular. You just ran it parallel, and I think you're saying there was very little difference. The noise was significant regardless of whether it was horizontal, vertical, or slant 45 when the antenna pickup was parallel to the display. Is that approximately what you experienced, Andy?
Exactly. Parallel to the display, across the screen, top to bottom, and left to right, made no difference in the amplitude. It when I brought it within an inch or two of the display, it would, the spikes would go up to greater than neg 95 to higher than, as I said before, minus 90 or even higher than that. Uniform across the screen. Don't remember what the sweep mode, what the span, rather the span mode was in, how wide I was looking, but it was a pretty wide bandwidth that I saw. Evenly spaced spikes across the screen.
Yeah, where those spikes were evenly spaced across the screen, you were either getting the so-called comb line effect. If you use a step recovery diode, I own a step recovery diode generator,
which is being fed a little bit less than 1 watt at 100 megacycles. It becomes a beautiful calibrator for a spectrum analyzer because it puts out almost equal power lines every single 100 megacycles, all the way up to roughly 13 gigahertz before they start falling off at roughly 6 dB per octave or so. So a good modern-day comb line generator has very little difference between the comb line at, say, 500 meg versus the comb line at 10 gigahertz. They're all 100 meg space. Therefore, each comb line becomes a beautiful frequency calibrator and amplitude calibrator when you're adjusting the in-tune tracking filter that's part of the spectrum analyzer. Andy, when you so I'm guessing that what you were seeing on the spectrum analyzer screen was either comb lines or time domain. In other words, the number of spikes you saw is a function of how fast it was sweeping. And you could have found that out real rapidly by increasing or decreasing the sweep speed if you had a manual override on that, and find out if the number of lines on the screen became increased or decreased. That would tell you, is it a comb line effect, or is it what I call time domain effect? Also, did you get a chance to hold your sniffing antenna on the back of the display? Well, in your case, you didn't have that capability. You'd be holding it on the back of the whole unit because the whole front face is the display. So I think you're saying nowhere except around the display itself did you see this effect. Back to you, Andy.
Okay. Exactly. It was just around the display area itself. And I'm going to be making further tests on this week. In fact, I'll be using it tomorrow. So I'll give you a further update, because I do want to make some more tests on this to find out what's going on. I just didn't have the time. I was in the middle of a testing situation when I noticed this, and I just wanted to confirm that there was a problem, external or internal, just so I could differentiate between what I'm doing and what's going on. A little bit under pressure at the time, so I didn't really get a chance to evaluate this closely. But tomorrow, I'm hoping to do this, so I'll have it in my hands again. And I'll give you a further update of what I find, and we'll go from there. Back to you.
Very fine, Andy. One last question. You probably set up, but I'm not sure, the Inritsu MT8802, you believe that's the serial number you were using, model number, and you believe that display is a TFT display. What's your guess as to the kind of display it was that you were seeing this phenomenon on, Andy? Go ahead.
I'm saying TFT, but it might be LCD. Eric might know the difference. Isn't one display better regarding parallax? If you view it at different angles, isn't a TFT supposed to be better as opposed to an LCD as far as looking at what you're trying to see at different viewing angles? Because this one has a pretty wide viewing range. So I would think it's TFT over LCD, but maybe I'm wrong. Dick?
Exactly. Go ahead, Eric.
Yeah, Andy, tell me what the model should be. Tektronix, you know, makes what they call digital phosphor oscilloscopes, which are neither liquid crystal nor a TFT, which is really a liquid crystal. You can tell, in terms of viewing angle, liquid crystals have to have a polarizing filter in front of them in order for them to work, in order for your eyes to see it. there are other types of displays, but it sounds to me like you're picking up the display itself. And by the way, Dick, when you change the sweep speed on most of these displays, you're actually not changing the sweep speed of the display, you're changing the speed at which you write into the display's memory. And the display's memory is constantly clocked out at a constant rate. So it's the kind of thing that if he's picking up the clocks from the display itself, they will be synchronous and they won't move anywhere.
Yeah, good point. So good news is these modern-day instruments are nice and compact and portable, battery-operated. The bad news is that many of the independent variable knobs I used to have, where I could change the sweep speed, the scan width, the filter resolution bandwidth. I can independently change those and play with them for various combinations to see certain phenomena in real time. And I guess I've lost many of those functions I used to have, and I'm going to miss them. Pays your money, it takes your choice. Okay, if anyone has any further comments or questions on this subject, before Mel goes to his mailbag, give me your call letters and name right now. H-U-L-A-W on the TechNet.
Was the moon, Dick?
Who was that asking about moon, and what was the question?
WSLM caller. Just a comment about the laser beams that were being bounced off the moon, off the reflectors at the Apollo astronauts left behind. Like I remember reading about this quite a few years ago, and a lot of people think that the laser beam was focused and you have to hit this little 10-inch by 10-inch mirror that was left up there and then bounced back as, you know, sharp laser light. You know, when it hits the moon from this telescope, they might have done it in a couple of places, but I think you said Arizona. It hits the moon, it's like, I don't know, 10 miles or bigger in diameter. So it's not like the final light traveling through space back here.
No, I think you're absolutely right, Paul. However, the laser retrodirective array that was left by the astronauts is something that has extremely high reflectivity compared to lunar soil. Lunar soil is pretty dark stuff. So even though you're lighting up a 10-mile diameter of the moon with that telescope and its laser transmitter, still, of the echo you get back, quite possibly the brightest part of that echo is the instrument that the astronauts put on the moon. When the average amateur aims his moon bounce antenna at the moon, with rare exception, the beam width of the antenna is many times wider than the moon. The moon is half a degree wide, and the guy could be using a real good moon bounce array, like my array of 16 EIDs, and that had a 5.5 degree beam width. So my beam width versus the moon's diameter is a 10-to-1 ratio. Only 1% of the energy of that very sharp-looking main lobe of that antenna of mine, only 1% of that energy would be hitting the moon. You take a guy, though, who's got a 15-foot dish on 10 gigahertz, now he has a beam width is, let me think what that beam width would be. I had 3-degree beam width, so 2-foot, 1/6 of that. Yes, half a degree. As you get to a 10 or so foot diameter dish on 10 gigs, you're now getting down to the beam width, which is equal to the angle subtended by the moon, and now the majority of the energy is hitting the moon. Use one of the great big radio telescopes, like the 150-foot dish at National Radio Astronomy Observatory, they can decide which crater they're going to aim their signal at and therefore get a favorable echo. Very few of us have got that kind of capability. Back to you, Paul, for any other comments. H-U-L-I-W, wait for the beep.
Okay, very good. Okay, I just wanted to bring that up. You know, when I first heard about this, maybe 35 years ago, I pictured this narrow beam traveling through space, you know, hitting this mirror. I would say, boy, that's some accomplishment to get that kind of angle and be able to illuminate that thing. But, it's still not an easy thing to do. They need some fine adjustments to even get that 10-mile diameter. But it's remarkable that this laser beam does start off, you know, less than a pencil thin, and it takes all that time, all those miles, 250,000 miles, and it spreads out over that distance. It's interesting thought. I wanted the listeners to realize that, you know, what's happening with this laser as it travels through space. It doesn't stay that way. you would think with a laser, oh, okay, this thing's going to stay as a fine pinpoint all the way out forever, but it doesn't affect you.
Yeah, one of the calculations I'm doing right now, and I get a chance to finish it, was what is the near field range of the 200-inch Mount Palomar telescope? I'm positive the near field